102 of the bill, and it's defined very broadly, and it's defined as a threat to cause physical injury or hold the person to ridicule, expose the fact that the person has committed a crime, and it's classified as a Class A misdemeanor. That's kidnapping and related offenses. The sexual offenses, it's the next article. Sexual offenses, there are four main crimes in this this article, and those are sexual assault in the first, second, and third degree, and sexual abuse of a minor. There are two other I consider relatively minor offenses in terms of what's likely to be charged, and that's incest and unlawful exploitation of a minor. Now, the policy changes, which is, I believe, on page 2 of the handout, summarizes the most important changes, and I think probably a good place to start would be just in those. Number one, there's no requirement of resistance that the sexual act is coerced by the threat of force or by the use of force. So if you prove that there was force involved, there's no need to prove resistance by the victim in order to get a conviction under sexual assault in the first degree or sexual assault in the second degree. And again, it's probably useful to turn to the definition of without consent on page 16. That's defined as, on line 21, with or without resisting is coerced by the use of force against personal property or by the express or implied threat of imminent death, imminent physical injury, or imminent kidnapping to be inflicted on anyone. So you prove that element, or you prove that the person was incapacitated, in other words, knocked out.
The Bible on that one.
Not sure I quite get the reference, but
the Bible says you can't charge somebody with rape with less resistance.
Well,
it's Deuteronomy.
I assume we do. So there's no requirement of resistance. Were you asking me something? No requirement of resistance if there's the use or threat of force. The second major change is that we have a felony offense involving sexual assault short of penetration. And that is defined on page 14 of the bill, line 8 through 13.
Sexual assault by short penetration.
Penetration, however, slight is sufficient. And this prohibits acts of sexual contact by the express or implied threat that are listed. The important thing to note, though, is the definition of sexual contact, and that is defined in the back of the bill on page
where one of the spousal immunity get removed.
I'll get to that in line 3. But that's defined as rather narrowly as genitals, anus, or female breast, and again, it has to be by force. The elimination of the spousal immunity rule, when the bill was presented to the House Judiciary Committee, there was a provision in there that said a person does not commit sexual assault if the victim is his or her legal spouse. That was taken out by the House Judiciary Committee, which I see as basically repealing the spousal immunity rule. And there has been some concern about whether we've done that by just not referring to it. And for the record, on page 14, line 29, when we're defining the crime of sexual abuse of a minor, we refer to sexual penetration with a person other than his legal spouse who's under 16 years of age.
I read that part, yeah. But that would be for those who were married,
right,
due to a pregnancy at an early age. Wouldn't necessarily cover standard spousal immunity.
Right, well, no, but that...
Wouldn't that
mean? Go ahead and finish your conversation that I have with her.
Yeah, I was going to say, just by making reference there to other than his legal spouse and not referring to it in other places, I think it's sufficient to evidence the intent, yeah, to include legal spouses.
What's the fellow from the Fairbanks Ferry, Andrew Klangfeld? Is that,
yeah,
his name? Well, that was a pretty good letter. Remember, I gave you,
yeah, and there was some.
And he raised a question about this particular section, I believe. And the way this reads, when you go to 440,
mm-hmm,
and you talk about sexual penetration,
mm-hmm,
then this would be very well and be very applicable to the 19-year-old guy that had sexual intercourse with a 13-year-old girl.
Okay, where exactly?
I'm bottom of page 14, then over on 15. But on the other hand, a 19-year-old girl could, with complete impunity, and be absolved from all culpability, have sexual intercourse with a 13-year-old boy.
Senator, that is, I think that Mr. Kleinfeld.
His assertion, not mine.
Yeah, I think Mr. Kleinfeld. Well, I think he misread the bill because, number one, we always refer to he in the bill.
I understand.
And he is intended to include she. The other thing is we define sexual penetration as including acts of cunnilingus and fellatio. And I gave this problem to legislative affairs, and Jim McKenzie drafted a suggested amendment to make it clear that the type of conduct described in the letter would be covered. It certainly is the intent to cover it, and I think it does, and legislative affairs included that it did also. But it certainly is the intent that if a woman forces a man to engage in sex, or an older woman has sex with a younger boy, that that would be covered to the same extent as if the roles were reversed.
Can I come back to the spousal abuse thing there? That's one
Did we ever get to it? Where are you looking, Senator?
Well, they left it out. It was on the first.
Oh,
you see, and so you're not going to see it in writing. It was just left out. And the thing is that I'm perfectly willing to charge a wife beater with rape so long as he inflicted physical injury. But I'm not willing to set up a blackmail situation when they divide the estate and stuff where she says, look, I'll charge you with, you know, give up.
Custody cases.
Yeah, custody cases. And so I say that I'm perfectly prove. She should have to prove injury, you know, that you actually beat it out of her. Or no way, I'm not going to wipe out totally that spousal immunity. I don't know about the rest of them. I think that's just, you know, I'm perfectly willing to deal different with an estranged couple. You know, the guy that, while they're still legally married, he comes and busts into the house. And, you know, that's different. But the thing is that I can just see that.
What about the threat of injury? Would that be sufficient?
No.
Okay.
Well, why don't you do this, may I suggest? Why don't you do this, Barry? Why don't you bring over some proposed language for reinsertion into the Senate version of this bill, which would perhaps satisfy Senator Tillion and the rest of us. You know, you're familiar with it, I know, and maybe you can just bring us something that takes care of Senator Tillion's proposal.
In other words, essentially provide that a spouse does commit the crime of sexual assault if it's established, in addition to the requirement set out for ordinary situations, that there was actual physical injury.
Yes.
Yeah.
After all, it's pretty hard to rape your wife, you know, under the law.
Yeah, and that's pretty hard to rape under any circumstance. You know.
I know. Yes. That's lots of words. Okay.
Comment.
If I could, I might note that the original proposal, as submitted to the legislature from the subcommittee, had a limited spousal immunity. It was, as I recall it, restricted to situations that would not be available where the spouses had separated and were living apart and one had filed for divorce.
Yeah.
Now, there was at one time also a proposal made that House Judiciary Committee that the requirement of filing for divorce be eliminated and simply not be available where the spouses had separated. But one of the responses to that, of course, was that a number of people today increasingly live in basically a common law relationship, and there's no valid reason to distinguish between that and a situation where someone has become separated from filed for divorce. So if you,
I'd like to see that back again, too, you know, for review. Committee action, maybe.
Yeah. Okay.
You're talking about the original provision, which
well,
I'd like to look at the original provision.
I would like to see them, you know, just give us some Xerox. copies.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's not very possible to have rates between spouses and that it shouldn't be charged, but none of the setup.
Well, like the couple has been out and they get into a big goddamn fight at the bar and they're half in the bag and they go home and the old man gets horny and she wants no part of it, you know.
Yeah, that might be reason to file for divorce if it's not rape.
We can worry about that later.
Not unless he...
That's assault with a friendly weapon.
Now we handle that, baby.
Well, shall we wait for you? Are you going to brew a cup of tea? He's not leaving. I think his shoes are still there. He probably doesn't realize that, though. Under this proposal, what describe to me what this does now, as far as rate between man and wife.
It says that if you prove the, it says that rate between man and wife is treated identically to rate between stranger and stranger. Yeah. There's no distinction under this proposal. And in terms of what other states have done, just for your information, the federal criminal code, which is, I think was passed by the Senate, eliminated, basically did the same thing. Oregon just essentially did the same thing a year ago. Those are the only two, two statutes which I know of that have done, got as far as the code. Treats all rates the same, regardless of the relationship of the parties.
Okay, what constitutes rape then?
Rape is sexual penetration without consent. Sexual penetration is defined as any intrusion into the genital or anal opening or oral sex. Without consent is defined as coercion by the use of force against the person or property, or by the express or implied threat of imminent death, imminent physical injury, or imminent kidnapping to be inflicted on anyone. And in House Judiciary, I think the committee initially started out as saying we were going to keep the rule as it is today, which says there are essentially no rape in marriage. But I guess when people got into the definition of without consent, in terms of the use of force or the threat of force, they felt that if you can establish that, then it shouldn't be a difference as to whether you were married or not.
What page are you looking at now?
The definition of without consent is page 16. On line 20 through 24, the definition of the actual crime of rape, although we don't call it rape in the code, we call it sexual assault in the first degree, that would be on page 13, line 24 through 25.
I like the New Hampshire law that was had several Christians and wife beaters were publicly whipped.
That's the comment, sir.
I like this.
The big broad bill. Yeah, I remember in 58 they had a little photograph of the New Hampshire prison.
Senator, there's two other major changes in the code, and one of them is listed on this list here, and that is the exclusion from the coverage of the criminal law, consensual sexual acts between adults in private with the exception of incest. That would include cohabitation, adultery, and consensual acts of sodomy between adults.
I should have known. Yeah, I don't want to fool around with anybody.
The only one other minor change.
You don't want to fool around with anybody?
Oh, sure. I don't want to fool around with any couple. Thank you. I want one alone.
You're gonna do your fooling around by yourself, right?
Not by myself, without a crowd.
We have a number of crimes in the code where, in this article, specifically sexual abuse of a minor, where the criminality of the conduct is dependent upon the age of the victim. And on page 15, lines 11 through 17, we recognize an affirmative defense, which says when the victim is less than 16, it's an affirmative defense that you reasonably believe the person to be over 16. However, when the victim turns out that the person was under 13, it's tough luck. It's strict liability. So if it's, as long as the person is over 13,
we've all seen girls at the age of 14, for example, who were sexually precocious and who could pass readily for 18 or 19.
No, I remember when Warren Taylor lowered the age of consent to 16, and a fellow who's now governor stood up for a little amendment that said, I move we make it mandatory. Oh, that makes sense.
It's really to give a guy a break if he had been led to reasonably believe that the broad was whatever.
Oh, I don't think that one works. They're not getting convictions in that area anyway, so this makes it a lot more sensible. I think they get more convictions on the villages.
Yeah, this is basically the majority rule now.
I don't know about your incest chapter. I might want to excuse me, Barry. I'm getting.
Oh, you know, I don't like. No, I don't. I've got one coming on that too. I think a stepchild needn't be covered the same as or an adopted child the same as.
That's
not truly incest. You know, if you're you got to fool around with your stepdaughter when she was 18, I don't think they should be able to charge you for incest.
It's not, though. I mean, well, it is and it isn't. There are two incest provisions, really, in the code. First is on page 14, lines 2 through 6, which deals with persons under 18, victims under 18.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, but the next one, then, is simply the crime of incest, which is on page 15, line 18 through 25. And
that do they hark back to the line 5 here?
Excuse me?
Is his son or daughter whether adopted, illegitimate, or a stepchild?
No, here we simply say ancestor or descendant of the whole or half blood.
Oh,
what about first cousins in your view of consanguinity? Now, I know, for example, that first cousins can get married in California and one other western state, but they can't in Alaska. Right? So what does this do with reference to consanguinity?
It,
the degree thereof.
It does not refer to under existing law. We simply say, I believe you can't. If incest, it was within the fourth degree of consanguinity, which I believe does include cousins. Under this proposal, it does not include cousins. It would include the situation. The furthest you would get away from first degree would be an uncle with the nephew or niece. That's as far as it would go. It would not be incest when it would be. Two cousins. And just as a side reference, the original proposal by the subcommission did not include the crime of incest. This was added by the House.
So I could marry under this code, I could marry my mother's brother's daughter.
Yeah, we're kind of close.
That's first cousins.
Yeah,
okay, I don't. The thing is, the incest statute does not go to marriage. The way it's defined, it simply says engaging in sexual penetration.
They couldn't get you for
the marriage
fun and frolic, but they could prohibit a legal marriage.
Exactly. The marriage would still be prohibited. It just would not be a C felony.
Okay.
The incest statute only refers to the act of sexual
penetration. But legal if I went to California or wherever and married my first cousin.
Right.
The place where the marriage took place. The law of that situs controls.
As to the actual marriage.
The validity of the marriage.
That's correct.
The valid were entered, valid in place.
Yeah.
Irrespective of local law.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is that a general?
Legal.
Yeah.
In other words, it's illegal to marry in certain states below the age of 16 without parental consent. In others, you can get married at 14 if two youngsters run to that latter jurisdiction. And get married where it is legal. That's a valid marriage when they get back.
What'd you call it?
We used to have
Good court and book.
Well, they used to have a lot of it when Dan and I were going, well, when I was going to law school, they had the miscegenation statutes in Virginia and other southern states where, you know, white could not marry a black.
That's a very sensible one.
Okay, continue, Bert.
That's what the lieutenant gave us.
I don't want to run anywhere.
What'd you call that?
Well, the law that deals with that kind of issue is called, I believe, conflicts. That's at least the course that I learned it in law school.
That's correct.
The law of conflicts, what law governs in that action.
So if it's legal in New Jersey, why start even though they went to Georgia?
I still want to get into that one, but I think you're...
Never mind, we don't need to.
There's only one other comment to touch on. Maybe I'm using the wrong word there in this area, but it's unlawful exploitation of a minor. And that's on page 15, line 26. This deals with, this is new to existing law.
Yeah, and it covers the blue film area, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Only with minors.
Yeah. Right.
Only with minors.
Right, that's not wrong with the blue film.
Well,
so what do you mean a blue film? What's
it? Deep throat.
Skinflix.
Devil and Miss Jones. Yeah. Skinflix, porn shows, whatever.
That's just you can't use a minor anymore.
Right.
And over a while they were going full
filter. I guess you can for home consumption only, because it's only if you want to do this for commercial purposes that you're in trouble. You could do a, you know, have a little family group and to do it, you know, just run it for the neighbors. Don't charge admission, and you're perfectly all right.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that there are two provisions in this code that deal with this topic. This is the one, again, for producing for commercial purposes, the blue movie.
Right.
Then we have a separate one, which we'll get to all the way to the back of the bill, that deals with the actual, if you have a picture that depicts it, it makes it a crime to sell it or possess with intent to sell. This simply, this provision, which is a B felony, gets the person that produces it or televises it. I probably should go through the 3 degrees of sexual assault quickly.
Well, wait a minute. You're talking about this commercial thing, right?
Yeah.
It says if the child under 16 years of age. What's the flip side of that? If the child is older than 16, you can go ahead and do this and make a commercial film.
Sure. You can make commercial
films. Is that right?
Yeah.
Sure. You got to remember the old First Amendment.
Yeah, right. That's their right to sexual expression. They have every right to make fun of it.
In this state, you can do it.
And you don't have to go. Though. I mean, you know, of course, it's not compulsory.
They make them right around Anchorage.
I'm sure they
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. The way for the hippie kids to pick up spending money.
I probably should go through these.
Doing what comes after.
Probably should go through these crimes rather quickly, just to be sure we touched on everyone. Sexual assault in the first degree, again, is A1, and that's the penetration without consent. That would be equivalent to rape in existing law. Penetration is defined to include acts of sodomy. Subsection A2 is defined as attempted sexual penetration without consent and causing serious physical injury. The form of assault with intent to commit rape as long as there's serious physical injury. Subsection A3 is sexual penetration with persons under 13. And what this says is an A felony in statutory rape when the person is under 13. We have another provision dealing with situations between 13 and 16, but this just raises the offense. Mm-hmm. In the press, it was alleged that we did not cover, that we lowered the penalty of statutory rape to 13. Well, I guess in a sense we did, in the sense that we made it a felony when it's under 13, but we still have it covered when it's between 16 and 13, which is the less serious crime. Subsection A4 is sexual penetration with a person under 18 who is entrusted to defend and secure, or is a son or daughter, or whether adopted, illegitimate, or stepchild. So this is dealing with persons under 18 only. It's not like the incest statute, which covers all types of conduct.
So well, why is it, I can see it for the incest section, you know. But over 16, that's the age of consent.
Yeah, you think it should be.
You think it should be, you know, if a stepdaughter seduces the old man and
in instances like this where there's the potential for, quote, overbearing, you deserve, you need two more years of protection. I mean, my own personal feelings, I might agree with you there. I don't. It would change existing law, though, in the sense of applying it to OP, that's 18. Sexual assault in the second degree by covered, which is the sexual contact without consent, essentially. Sexual assault in the third degree is kind of a kinky little statute, and it covers two types of conduct where there's probably little coverage in existing law. The first is sexual penetration where the person known to be suffering from a mental disorder or defect, rendering the person incapable of appraising the nature of his conduct under circumstances where a person capable of consenting would not have engaged in the act. This is trying to deal with a situation where the ward attendant engages in sexual penetration with one of his patients, a mentally ill patient who the person knows, who the attendant knows is incapable of consenting.
Yeah, they just have a shrink of that.
Well, it originally drafted, it was a lot broader, and it originally covered sexual penetration with a person who is suffering from a mental disorder or defect. And you had to just be reckless as to whether the person was suffering from such a disorder. Now, basically, in the suggestion of Attorney General Gross, we added this language, under circumstances where a person capable would not have engaged in the act. It kind of covers a situation where everyone knows that it was someone, you know, was a situation where it wasn't consent, where the person was being taken advantage of. And frankly, of all the provisions in the code, this is one of the most difficult areas because it's very hard to draft something like this without saying across the board that if you're suffering from a mental disease, you can't engage in sexual conduct.
Yeah.
That's our attempt to do so. Subsection A2 is sexual penetration with a person known to be incapacitated. Incapacitated is defined on page 16 as a person who is temporarily incapable of appraising the nature of his conduct and is physically unable to express unwillingness to act. Now, that's
in other words, blah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that the House Judiciary Committee substantially tightened up that definition. It was originally drafted. It simply said incapable of appraising the nature of his conduct. And it was felt that that would be too broad because, you know, when you have a couple of drinks, are you incapable of appraising the nature of your conduct? So it was added in, you know, both incapable and physically unable to express the willingness to act. So you have to be, not only have to be drunk, you have to be dead drunk, essentially.
Yeah.
Sexual abuse of a minor deals with consensual sexual acts with people under 16 that do not fall under this category or that category. You engage in, if you're
so at the lower grade statutory rate.
Yeah, exactly. And it's more than statutory rate because it covers the act of sexual contact. First, at 16 or older, engaging in penetration with a person under 16 but over 13. The other one is contact with a person under 13, consensual. And we treat that as a C felony. The subsection A2 is being 19 years of age or older, sexual contact with a person under 16 but 13 or older, we treat that as a misdemeanor. That's our, and I, the penalty on this, I should point out, in some ways, well, you know, it depends how you look at this conduct. If you see this contributing, it's a misdemeanor. If you see it as lewd and lascivious, it would be a felony under existing law. The committee felt that since it would be dealing with perhaps a person 20 having sex with a person 15 under consensual acts, and because of the broad definition of contact, it should only be an A misdemeanor. So.
Oh, I like it. I saw Kevin Hall with a record, you know, 18 years old. He gave beer, you know, a beer party to a girl 17. They were married a year later, but you know, he's always got it on his record. He was busted and charged.
sexual offenses, the last article in this chapter is robbery, and that's, I need to make a chart for that because it's fairly easy to explain. If a person is going to be armed with a deadly weapon, or represents that he's armed with a deadly weapon, or uses a dangerous instrument, or causes serious physical injury, it's going to be an A felony. Any other type of robbery is going to be a B felony. So any time the person is armed with a deadly weapon, or just simply puts his hand in his pocket and tries to convey the impression that he's armed, you're going to have your A felony there. B felony if the person isn't armed, he just is strong-armed.
Or a strong-arm. Huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That changes existing law in the sense we have 2 degrees of robbery, but I think the distinction is a valid one, and the distinction allows you to treat certain robberies as A felonies by saying if you're armed or represent.
If you're armed, you should really be salted away.
Yeah, that's a lucid enough section.
Yeah.
I
like it.
If you say I'm going to pull a pistol out of my pocket and drill you if you don't cooperate, why, that's Class A, whether you have a pistol or not.
And what I'm thinking about is when the guy relaxes and you gun him down, what did he get charged with?
Oh, under the code, that would be justifiable. Specifically say you may use deadly force to prevent a robbery under the justification provision.
What about burglary?
Burglary, you may use deadly force to terminate a burglary.
You can set a trap gun.
Oh, no.
I don't know if you need a specific reference in the code to that or not. In the commentary we discussed, it was the intent of the subcommittee not to allow people to use trap guns because the code refers to using deadly force when to the extent the person reasonably believes it necessary.
Okay, in other words, you've got to be convinced while you're there when the guy comes in that I'd better shoot him before he shoots me.
Mm-hmm.
But no.
If it's, well, even.
You can't leave a booby trap.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but you don't have to. Can you gun him down as he leaves?
Well, let me just, it's an important enough provision to be sure we're on a specific language, so let me just get that.
I mean, you know, that's.
I think
from what I read earlier that if he's entered my property, he's mine, even if he's out in the front lawn when I finally get a clear shot.
Well, it says you may use deadly force upon another when to the extent to reasonably believe it necessary to terminate what you reasonably believe to be a burglary occurring in an occupied building or dwelling.
If he's running with something of mine.
Now, I wish I could say that I was sure of the answer. I'm not sure when the burglary ends. It may just end as soon as he...
Soon as he gets fired.
Yeah, sure, money will run. If he's got something of mine, he's going to be dead.
I feel relatively certain about it. When he's gone, when he's running.
But if he's still carrying something of yours.
That's
you mean when he came into your house and stole something?
That was burglary when he came.
That was burglary. And he's running with it. Got one of my nice Persian rugs over his shoulder.
He's already committed.
He's
already committed.
I'm afraid I'd be in trouble.
But I should point out, though, is that you could be used. Okay, this is getting a little ahead, but there's one hand the defense of terminating a burglary. There's another defense of making an arrest, citizen's arrest. Under the code, you may use deadly force to make an arrest when you're attempting to arrest a person who's committed a felony which involved the use of force against the person. So if there was force used against you, you could. Additionally, the person is escaping or attempting to escape from custody while in possession of a firearm, you could use deadly force. But I guess I would have to agree with Dan's analysis on it. The code is drafted now. It says if he gets outside your house, you call the police. If you don't use deadly force, you could use non-deadly force, which includes a threat to use deadly force. In other words, you could say stop or I'll shoot. If he doesn't stop,
how about busting his legs out from under him?
That would not be deadly force because deadly force is defined as force used with the intent of causing death or serious physical injury. And if you got up and you said, no, I didn't intend to cause serious physical injury, I simply intended to stop the person, I don't think that would be used as deadly force.
How would you do that?
George. Turn in next Thursday.
Buster's late, I come on to the left. No, I'm talking about my 375.
Barry, while he's talking, I for one thank you for the outline, the index,
yeah.
The index and the outline, and I hope that as we go through the code, you'll be doing this at every meeting, because
yeah.
It's most helpful, really.
Yeah.
How much further did you plan on going today? The end of the
we're,
outline?
We're through, yeah, the end of the outline. That was
yeah.
a bit very much as against the person.
Well, I've got some on firearms that I, you know, this thing.
Weapons explosives.
No, I'm talking about with my pistol that has a socket under the seat on the car.
Oh,
that now becomes illegal.
Yeah, that's another point that's been raised in some correspondence I've had here and there.
I carry one just to put a moose out of the way, you know, when somebody hits one or something.
Did we go to work at 2 on Thursday?
2 o'clock, right. Dan has some comments he'd like to make. 2 to 4, I guess, unless there's a... We don't have any comments.
No, that's good. Let's get this thing. I think it's a fairly usable bill. Wouldn't you say?
Well, we'd better go through it and then go back and hear some of the opponents as well as the proponents.
Oh, yes, right. I expect them to solidify them.
Let me say for the record, my name is Dan Hickey. I spoke with Senator Homan earlier today about how he would like to proceed from the point of view of the administration. And on Tuesday, Mr. Gross, myself, and Commissioner Burton would like to appear and basically give a general presentation of the code from the administration's perspective. But Senator Homan asked me to extend possible, try and keep up with your daily schedules in terms of the division that's here and making any individual comments. Now, in addressing some of the individual provisions in the code, I hope you don't construe certain points I raise or criticisms that I might have as it being sort of representative of the code as a whole or the package. Starting with the homicide provisions, I think there are a couple of areas in there that could stand for clarification, particularly on page 7 in section 1141.115, defenses to murder. You'll notice that the in subsection A, the second defense is that the defendant's conduct consisted of aiding without the use of duress or deception another person to commit suicide. That's lines 23 and 24 on that page. That would seem to infer that where a suicide has been occasioned through the actions of another party through the use of duress or deception, that the offense would be murder. It's not as clear as I think it might be that that's the case. Furthermore, I see a technical problem with treating the thing as a defense, and basically when it's raised, in other words, when a defendant raises some inference of suicide, the burden would then be on the prosecution to prove a negative, if you will. In other words, that duress or deception was not used. It seems to me that a better way of doing this, particularly in conjunction with the way an intentional aiding of a suicide is manslaughter on page 9, would be to add language in the murder provision itself, providing that where an individual caused the death of another person by conduct which basically constituted compulsion or inducement through duress or deception to commit a suicide, that it would be murder. I believe that would, and then simply drop out the fence, and I think that you'd have essentially the same result without creating any confusion. And I have a
proposed, you have a draft on that.
A proposed, Senator Homan had asked me to the extent possible to
have your proposal.
Try and have a something drafted up. Basically, that amendment would then involve
that's not too bad.
Murder in the first degree, simply saying, a person commits the crime of murder in the first degree if with intent to cause the death of another person, he, one, causes the death of another person, or two, compels or induces through duress or deception another person to commit suicide. Now, another
that's
reason
a lot more relaxed from this point, yeah.
Another reason why I think it's a bit of an improvement is that I have some difficulty with the notion of aiding somebody to commit suicide through duress or deception. That doesn't seem to me to be really descriptive of what you're doing. You're really inducing or compelling, I think. It's a relatively technical point.
Well, I mean, I don't, it would cover the old fellow dying who asked you, would you fetch his pistol and load it for him and leave it by the bed, which has been done a number of times.
Or,
then you're not
or mercy killings of any kind.
Yeah, well, mercy killings, I can see it. If he asked you to kill, to pull the trigger, as the fellow did for me, I can't do that. But I'll leave the firearm where he can reach it and leave. And if he wants to, that's his business, you know?
The really serious situation that the existing subsection and the proposed amendment really goes to are suicide pacts where two people, generally a man and a wife, agree to commit suicide together. And
the survivor chickens.
And the situation you have occasionally, and it's never arisen in this jurisdiction that I know of, is where you figure out a good way to get rid of the old lady is because of certain circumstances, you convince her that the two of you should commit suicide. You have absolutely no intention to do so. And
dirty trick.
There are two cases on it, actually.
And she does.
Laughing all the way.
She does and you don't.
Such an irreversible thing, isn't it?
Well, if I didn't say irreversible, but it's pretty hard to be arrested for committing suicide.
Okay. The second, again, a technical area that I have is also under that same section, 115, and Barry alluded to the fact that I had some question about it, and it's on page 8, lines 7 through 9, which presently would read, in a prosecution under section 110A3 of this chapter, which is the felony murder section, the only underlying crime was burglary in the first degree, and the defendant intended to kill or cause serious physical injury to the person he is charged with killing. I also have an amendment that I think would serve to clarify that a bit. That section was rewritten by House Judiciary, and it's one that I'm basically responsible for putting into the program circuit. It's a relatively difficult concept, but let me take a stab at trying to explain to you what it's about. Burglary is basically a crime as follows. You break and enter into a building with the intent to commit another crime. Okay? Now that other crime can be anything. Usually it's to steal, commit theft. It can also be to rape. It could also be to murder. The point of this section is to say that if I break and enter into your house with the intent to kill you,
and do so,
and I do so, I cannot be prosecuted for felony murder. I can only be prosecuted for either intentional murder or manslaughter. Now, there's two basic reasons why this section is very important and very necessary. The first is that if in fact I'm guilty of an intentional killing, murder, when I kill you, if the state charges me alternatively in two counts, one with intentional killing and one with murder, and the jury acquits me on intentional killing but convicts me on felony murder, those are inherently inconsistent verdicts, because in order to convict me of felony murder, the jury would basically have to find that I had the intent to kill and killed, because they would have to find that I broke and entered with the intent to kill.
Some states, if I'm not mistaken, have gone to Maine, for instance, if armed and you enter, it is considered the intent to kill. It's attempted murder if you are armed with a firearm and have entered somebody's dwelling. That's attempted murder, even if you had no intent to, because the very fact that you carried a firearm in there led to the conclusion that you might have to kill to get out. And so in jurisdictions where you enter, that's a very nice one, really, because it discourages the burglar from carrying a firearm, because being caught with a firearm in a dwelling results in a murder charge.
You mean this presumption?
It's a presumption of attempted murder to take a firearm into someone else's house.
A rebuttable presumption, I would assume.
It's a rebuttable presumption, yes, but it nevertheless is prima facie evidence of intent to commit bodily harm. And, you know, that solves quite a bit of this, if you did that.
Depending on how it was worded, I'd have to take a look at it. It sounds like it's probably pretty complicated.
All you have to do is have a firearm.
Let Dan move along.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
The other basic reason for it is that it would preclude the availability of a defense of serious provocation to a defendant unless you had that there. Because a defendant who in any other circumstances would have a heat of passion defense, which is provided for under existing law, it would preclude the availability of a defense of serious provocation to a defendant unless you had that there. Thank you.
could be arising in the following situation. Take a child who is born in rural areas and supposedly established 6 months later, and the parents, for one reason or another, really weren't quite sure when they were born. But they can pin it down to the place of birth. So first, they're going to get an error to this.
They would hopefully get to what surely code is going to be application. Surely the bag, bag forgery, arson, burglary, affected against the family, prostitution, gambling. So, what's going on? Only one of them is on top. I've given out a pair of shoes on. Policy changes in the bill from the system law should have that in your file. And I know Dan has given out an amendment sheet that I just received a copy of, and I just kind of went through fairly quickly all
although if I glance through it quickly, I don't see that there's any problem. With a sex offense is necessary 17 of the bill. And on the sheet, I guess just to summarize the chapter in terms of the major changes. The first major change is that we have a consolidated sex statute. We don't have separate provisions on larceny and embezzlement, except by receiving, except by false pretenses. It's all going to be set. Another major change is that there's a set of a firearm or explosive, it's going to be a true felony. Whereas in the existing law, the state and the value of the firearm or explosive. We also have a general provision in the code which says we aggregate all amounts in property crimes committed under one course of conduct. So we have instances of a scheme involving, say, dead sex, where there were 10 checks and each one was $50. Set by receiving statute. Under current law, set by receiving statute requires the person to receive stolen goods knowing it's going to be stolen. It's held by the House Judiciary Committee that that's a true prison standard and it's only a reckless standard. Reckless disregard is whether it's stolen. The person put on notice, a reasonable person would have known, and in fact, not only would a reasonable person would have known, but 95% of the people would know, and the form broker would buy it, but it would have known. We have a shoplifting statute which allows felony penalties to be the item of shoplifting is over $500, so it's needed to the law. Joint writing and House Judiciary Committee was made a felony. That is a new existing law in the sense that joyriding is currently involved in what you would call anything. It's really the most part of the committee. And I know that the Attorney General is opposed to that. We also have a provision on a specific statute covering removal of identification marks on items such as construction tools, serial numbers on items such as television sets. You must prove an intent to render the to cause interruption to the ownership of another. So it's not getting that conduct where you own a television set for some own personal reason, you want to get a serial number or up, it's getting it, I think, large scale type of speed and allows it. Going to the start, the consolidated sex statute is defined in section 100. Within that statute, we include the defined as larceny, embezzlement, displayed property, set by deception, set by receiving, set by services. And again, it's important to note that what section 100, which is on page 17 of the bill today, describes what theft is. It does not provide for the crime of theft, but rather describes what theft is. And some of the provisions refer to other sections described in more detail, for example, how theft by deception is committed. But under the code, if you commit any of the conduct that's described in section 100, you would commit theft, and you would be charged on page 18 with theft in first, second, or third degree. And the degree structure is based primarily on value. If it's $500 or more, then the subject of theft is going to be a true felony. If it's over $25,000, it's going to be a true felony. Now, that's because there may be technical change there. So we have that $25,000 figure as part of the penalty structure. And I know Dan testified a couple days ago that it may be more appropriate to set it out as a separate degree rather than leave it as a sentence. Theft in the first degree also includes theft of a firearm or explosive and theft on the person, regardless of value, for example, pickpocketing. Theft in the second degree, which is section 140, that's what it means, is theft of items $50 to $500 or theft of a credit card. Under $50, the fee is considered. value of the property in time, place, and criminal act. And you can't ascertain what the market value would be or place. Extortions on page 20, that's not part of the consolidated assessed statute because here we're really not concerned about the amount of the property that is taken. It's just simply the obtained property by threat, and we define what a threat is on page 102 of the bill, which is being shown. And under existing law, extortion is treated less seriously than a law enforcement. And under the code, that's the word. Extort money is really serious. Next statute would be called theft by failure to make the required disposition of funds to the vehicle held. And what this deals with is the situation where, say, an employer receives payment from his employee, say, for United Fund, and he doesn't make the payment. He exercises control of his own. I think I'm on page. No, it's fine. It's bottom page 20 and top 20. 21, all 21 possible. Start down to 127. That would be like stopping something. Under those circumstances, where his wife is picked up at the leading run, should he be subject to liability?
Well, the court, whatever we do in the front of some of the with his decision to take somebody else.